Chapter 12. Maddie picks the planetarium for what Sander has annoyingly started to call our first date. I try to downplay it to him, explaining to him that Maddie and I are just hanging out, but he can tell how excited I am, and that only encourages his teasing. The couple of days before the date are filled with equal parts training and unsolicited girl advice. Tell her how pretty she looks. I stop a heavy bag from careening into me with my telekinesis. Ask her questions about herself. I duck under a swarm of projectiles. Make sure you look interested in what she's saying, even if you're not. I pivot around a drone, hitting it with a backhand swipe of my pipe staff. Are you listening to me? I wipe sweat from my face and glare at Sander. Not really. Good. He claps his hands, powering down the lecture hall. Then you're ready. Maddie's waiting for me outside the planetarium. Her smile is small and nervous as I approach. She's wearing a light sweater and jeans, which makes me glad I didn't take Sander's advice to dress up like we were going to the opera or something, opting instead for my usual hooded sweatshirt and jeans. I hope you don't think this is nerdy, she says as we buy tickets. No, not at all. Nerdy isn't the word I'd choose. Ironic, maybe. I can't explain to her how quaint I find the human's understanding of the known cosmos. I wonder if other aliens in hiding have had first dates at the planetarium. I doubt it. My dad used to take me to the planetarium all the time when I was a kid. I got pretty into it. As we take our seats in the domed auditorium and wait for the show to start, she tells me more about her family. Her father is some kind of renowned astronomer, her mother a professor of philosophy. They moved to Chicago so her mother could take a position at the university, but they still travel frequently, since her dad's in high demand on the space nerd lecture circuit. Maddie sounds sad when she talks about them, like they're never around. Our situations are so different, yet somehow I feel like I know exactly where she's coming from. I miss them, she says, then waves her hands apologetically. I mean, they're not gone forever, but it's like I hardly see them since we moved here. Isn't that weird, being on your own? She shrugs. It can be cool. No one to yell at me for staying up late on a school night. She shoots me a playful glance, or to wonder why I'm bringing strange boys to the planetarium. I laugh, but I also wonder if she really thinks I'm strange. I hope not. I think I'm doing a pretty good job of being regular Stanley. Ugh, I'm going on and on. I just unloaded all that on you, and I don't know anything about you. I'm disappointed that she's done talking. Contrary to what Sander thought, I didn't have to feign interest. But now comes the part where I have to lie to her. What do you want to know? Maddie thinks this over. Around us, other people are taking seats. I notice that our shoulders are touching, sharing an armrest. Let's start with where you go to school. I flash an embarrassed smile. I'm homeschooled. She gives me a look that makes me think I might as well have told her I'm an alien from the planet Lorien. I remember the weird looks that the mics gave me at the rec center, like I was some kind of creepy shut-in. I could have come up with a cover story, I guess, but it feels better to tell her the truth. Huh, she says, her eyebrow arched jokingly. And here you seemed so normal. It's really not that weird, I tell her. My uncle, he keeps things interesting. Actually, maybe it is sort of weird, come to think of it. My uncle's not exactly what you'd call normal. So you live with him? Yeah. Where are your parents? I should have a convincing lie ready for that question. Sander and I used to drill backstory when we were on the road, but it's been a long time. Sander would tell people that I was his nephew, and that he was taking me on a trip to show me the world, or so that my parents could have a second honeymoon, or that my parents would be joining us eventually. Sometimes he got closer to the truth, telling sympathetic diner waitresses that he was raising me after both my parents had died in an accident. That usually resulted in a bigger-than-normal slice of dessert. I want the Stanley that Maddie gets to know to be as close to the real me as possible. They died when I was young, I tell her. I never really knew them. Oh, she replies, clearly not sure what to say next. Thankfully, the lights dim before the conversation gets any more depressing. We recline in our seats as the Milky Way comes alive above us. A tinny recording begins, describing the origin of the cosmos and running down the roster of planets in relation to Earth. I'm not listening. Lounging in the near darkness with Maddie is pretty much all my brain is capable of processing. I want to remember these details. Her hair smells like vanilla, or coconut, or some other girly thing. Whatever it is, it's great. I concentrate on the space on the armrest where our shoulders meet, imagining that her every shift in position is some coded message for me. I glance over at her. Maddie notices and gives me a quick smile, her face bathed in whites and pale blues of the light presentation overhead. I'd spend the rest of this boring lecture staring at her if that wouldn't make her think I was a freak. Instead, I tune out the planetarium soundtrack and listen to her. Her breathing is slow and steady, but using my enhanced hearing, I can tell her heart is pounding. Or wait, maybe that's my heart. I close my eyes and spend the rest of the show like that. Afterward, the planetarium stays dimmed, the stars still on display. The rest of the people begin filing out while we stay in our seats. Eventually, it's just the two of us and the stars. Maddie leans close to me and begins to whisper, even though we're alone. She tells me about constellations that weren't covered in the recording, guiding my eyes from Orion's belt to Aquarius. She laughs softly and corrects me when I mistake the tail of Pisces for one of Pegasus's legs. I already know everything that she's telling me, but it's all so much more interesting with her narrating. At some point, without even realizing I'm doing it, I take her hand. It's only for a moment. Her hand is warm and a little damp with sweat. She quickly slips away and stands up. "I'm sorry," I start, realizing I overdid it. "I mean, I didn't mean..." "It's okay," she says, shaking her head, looking flustered but not mad or weirded out. "Come on. You can walk me home." Chapter 13. Sander isn't in the penthouse when I get home, which gives me a couple of hours of alone time to endlessly replay in my head what I've started thinking of as the hand-holding incident. I don't think I even put this much thought into suckering in that Moog. Did I misread Maddie's interest? When Sander comes home with a soggy bag of takeout, he doesn't even ask me about my date. Instead, he wants to talk about his day prowling the city. "I drove all over the city with this thing," he says, holding up his heavy-duty version of my iMoog. "Nothing. Not a single blip. If that Moog had any friends looking for him, they've moved on. I think we're in the clear." "That's great," I reply distractedly. "To hiding in plain sight," he toasts, raising a freshly mixed drink. Over burgers, Sander finally gets around to asking about Maddie. I tell him everything, not leaving out a single detail, even trying to recreate Maddie's body language for him. For the first time since we've been in Chicago, I feel like I could really use my Sepan's guidance. "Huh," he says when I finish.
"Huh? That's it?"
He shrugs.
"Women are mysterious creatures."
As he says this, he gives me a strange look, half smirking and half apprehensive, like I'm some kind of weird animal he's afraid will bite him.
"What?"
I ask. "I just can't remember the last time you talked this much. It's nice." I wave him away. "You're no help." Just then, my back pocket vibrates. Immediately, my heart is in my throat. My iMoog is signaling a warning. I practically tear the device out of my pocket, staring down at the screen. But it's blank. Just a solitary white dot in the center. My cell phone, I realize. It was my cell phone. I carry my phone mostly out of habit. It hardly ever vibrates, unless Sander wants me to pick him up a bagel on the way home from my run. The screen blinks with a new text message. "It's her," I announce, almost too nervous to open the message.
"What's it say?"
"Had fun today," I read. "For the next date, you're picking the place." Sander whoops and mimes a high five from across the table.
So, she thought it was a date, too. And if she had fun, that means I didn't screw up too badly with the hand-holding. I don't have long to savor these facts as a fresh wave of anxiety washes over me. She wants me to plan a date. What's wrong? Sander asks, reading distress in my expression. I have no idea where to take a girl on a date. Sander cuts short a laugh. We sit in silence, both of us pondering. I could take her back to the Windy City Wall, I suggest. I could definitely kill that wall now. Sander makes a face. You want to spend a date climbing rocks instead of talking to her? He has a point. You know, Sander muses, if you really want to impress her, I have an idea. Chapter 14. I make plans with Maddie for the following weekend, which makes the weekdays in between a slog through endless anticipation. I'm filled with nervous energy, but not the kind I can channel into my training sessions with Sander. The drones score more hits on me than they should, my mind occupied with cycling through wardrobe choices and practicing imaginary conversations. I can tell Sander is annoyed as he powers down the lecture hall. Do you think the Mogadorians will care that you've got a girl on your mind? He snaps. I offer my best contrite headshake, knowing he's right. Later, Sander summons me to his workshop. He's got his feet up on his desk, crumpling a stack of old blueprints. He has a distant look in his eyes, and for a second, I think I'm interrupting some pleasant daydream. He looks me over with a wistful smile. You know, I wasn't much older than you are now when I was assigned to be your Sepan, he says. That's young for a Sepan to be assigned to a guard. I was good, though. I'd helped the engineers, much older, more experienced, with some tech projects. I think they wanted to get me in the field as soon as possible. I'd been expecting a lecture from Sander. That's something I'm used to. Annoyed Sander was a familiar entity. Nostalgic Sander, on the other hand, I've got no idea how to deal with. It's so rare for him to talk about Lorien, I'm afraid to interrupt. I like to think I was ready, he continues. It was a big honor, that's for sure. Even if you were an unruly little piece of work. He winks at me, and I can't help but smile. Bonding with a guard, that's a full-time responsibility. As ready as I wanted to be, I had other things on my mind, too. I had a girlfriend. Things were getting kind of serious, you know? I was trying hard to balance it all. What happened? I ask, before realizing what a stupid question that is. A shadow crosses Sander's face, although he's quick to hide it. You know what happened. Sander sits up and tears a piece of paper out of a legal pad. He hands it to me, the lines filled with his precise writing. A shopping list. Since you're no good to me in the lecture hall, you might as well go run some errands, he says, stern Sander resurfacing. I take the list and head for the door, but Sander stops me. I never figured out that balance, he says. Maybe you can. Until you do, just remember what your real responsibilities are. All right, man? This isn't the first time I've run errands for Sander. It isn't groceries he sends me out into the world for. That'd be too easy. I'm after spare parts. It's not like we couldn't just order whatever high-tech items Sander needs for his drones off the internet, but I think he enjoys the challenge of taking broken-down Earth junk and making it work again. He's tried to get me more involved in his salvage projects, but it's never really worked. I'm way more interested in smashing his inventions than putting them together. I spend the afternoon dutifully patrolling downtown's pawn shops and thrift stores. I find a few things on Sander's list. An ancient compact disc player and an automatic vegetable slicer with curving blades that I dread to see flying at me in the lecture hall. I also pick up some stuff I know he's always on the prowl for. A fried circuit board here, an orphaned length of cable there. It isn't until the last thrift store on my route that I get the tingly feeling that someone is watching me. Instinctively, I make a discreet check of my IMOG. There's no sign of danger nearby. As I slip the device back into my pocket, I notice her. Standing two aisles over, next to a rack of vintage t-shirts, is Maddie. At first, I think it must be my eyes playing tricks on me. She's been on my mind so much that I'm starting to hallucinate. Then Maddie holds up her hand in a shy wave, and I practically bound over to her. "Hey!" I exclaim, trying not to sound too excited and probably failing. "What are you doing here?" "Hey," she replies, glancing around like she's as surprised to be in a musty thrift store as I am to find her here. "I'm, stalking you?" I grin like an idiot. "Seriously?" "No," she rolls her eyes. "My dad, he's really into antique telescopes and stuff like that. I'm just looking around." "Oh," I say, playing crestfallen. "I was actually hoping you were stalking me." Maddie glances at the bags I'm holding from other stores, each of them bulging with weird shapes. "What's all that?" "Science project stuff," I say, thinking quickly. "For homeschool?" I shrug. "My uncle is weird." Together, we wander the aisles of the thrift store. Maddie pulls a maroon leisure suit off a rack and holds it up to me. "Maybe you should wear this on our date this weekend," she says, cocking her head, trying to imagine me in the suit. Sander would probably burn this suit if I dared desecrate the penthouse with its presence. "Would you even come outside if I showed up in this?" "Probably not. Here, hold it up," she orders, and I take the suit with my free hand. Before I realize what she's doing, Maddie's held up her phone and snapped my picture. She laughs, looking at what I'm sure is my startled expression above the most hideous suit in history. "Perfect," she says. "Hello, new wallpaper." "Now I definitely have to buy it. You've talked me into it." When I jokingly check the price tag, a moth flutters out from the sleeve. I drop the suit, grossed out, and Maddie laughs again. We dart out of the store, the old man behind the cash register glaring at us. "I hope I don't have fleas," I say once we're out on the sidewalk. "Actually, I think I see one," she says. She leans close, inspecting, and then gives me a quick peck on the cheek. She leans back and laughs again, this time at what must be the dumbfounded expression on my face. "See you Friday, Stanley," she says playfully, adding, "Take a bath." Chapter 15. It's the big night. Sander and I stand in the sub-basement garage of the John Hancock building. Arrayed before us, each neatly tucked beneath a tarp, is Sander's collection of getaway vehicles. Really, I've never thought we needed more than one car. Sander, however, has taken to collecting the things since we've been in Chicago, outfitting each with his various improvements. I guess Sepans need hobbies, too. He's lucky that being a Sepan comes with unlimited funds. Sander pulls the tarp away from a sleek, dark, red convertible. He runs a hand lovingly across the hood. Then he gives me a deadly serious look. "Please don't make me regret this." I grin at him, eager to get behind the wheel. That smile doesn't exactly inspire confidence. Still, he opens the driver's side door for me, and I hop in. Sander leans in the window as I adjust the seat and mirrors. "How fast are you going to go?" he asks. 5 miles under the speed limit at all times," I recite. We've had this conversation all week, ever since Sander suggested I take one of the cars. "Always signal, no racing to catch yellows, keep the top up. I get it." "You better," replies Sander, his tone more parental than ever. He looks a bit anxious about the way I'm excitedly drumming my hands on the wheel. But he steps back. "Have a good time," he says. I carefully pull out of the parking garage. Sander, watching me and nervously rubbing his beard, disappears in my rearview mirror. When I'm a few blocks away from the John Hancock building, I hit the button to roll the top down. What Sander doesn't know won't hurt him. I'm picking Maddie up at the park across the street from the rec center. The convertible handles like a dream, and I cruise over to the park following all of Sanders' rules. Except for the top, of course. The cool night air swirls around me, and I feel energized. This is as free as I've ever felt. Maddie is sitting on the bench when I pull up, and does a double take when she sees me behind the wheel. I wave her over. "Want to go for a ride?" I ask.
"Oh, wow. Is this yours?"
"My uncle's," I tell her, shrugging nonchalantly. "He's cool with it." Maddie glances up and down the street, a bit apprehensive. "You're a good driver? I can trust you?" Okay, I don't technically have a license, but I do have an extremely convincing fake that Sander forged in his workroom. I've also got plenty of experience behind the wheel. Back when we were nomads, Sander had me practice driving as soon as my feet could reach the pedals, mostly to relieve him when he got tired.
"Of course," I reply.
We engage in a mini staring contest, her jokingly sizing up my trustworthiness, me trying my hardest to look innocent. I can't help the devilish smile that creeps across my face.
"Aha," she says, pointing. "The look of a speed demon."
Before I can defend myself, Maddie vaults over the passenger door and flops down in the seat beside me. She flashes me a lopsided grin. "I've always wanted to do that." I can't take my eyes off her. Right then, Maddie looks more beautiful than I've ever seen her. I watch as she pulls her hair back into a ponytail, not wanting to get it tangled in the wind. I'm immediately swept into a vision of just driving forever, out of Chicago. It doesn't matter where, as long as Maddie's next to me. Still, something nags at me. A sensation that I can't quite place, adding a dark edge to what is an otherwise perfect moment. I ignore the feeling. "Ready?" I ask her.
"Ready,"
she answers. I don't take my eyes off her as I pull away from the curb with a flourish. Immediately, I rear-end a conversion van that's double-parked a few feet away. That definitely wasn't there a few minutes ago.
"Ugh,"
groans Maddie as we're both jerked forward. "Are you all right?" I ask, my hands shaking uncontrollably on the wheel. I'm simultaneously terrified that I've hurt her, and mortified that I've made such an unbelievable asshole of myself.
I think so, she stammers.
In front of us, the doors of the conversion van swing open and three men jump out. They're all dressed in dark clothes, matching fedoras pulled low over pale faces. I realize that in my back pocket, my iMoog is vibrating like crazy. Chapter 16. I don't need the incessant vibrating from my pocket to tell me that the three men standing in front of my car are Moogs. I know my enemy. "They probably want your insurance info," says Maddie as she begins rifling through the glove box. For a second, I try to convince myself that this could just be a coincidence, that they don't know exactly who or what I am. But they're not looking at the damage to their van. I've crumpled their back bumper pretty good and shattered one of their taillights, but they don't seem to care. All three of them stare at me. Slowly, one of them begins to reach under his coat. There's no way this is random. Wishful thinking. My date is ruined before it's even started.
"Hell with it,"
I growl and throw the car into reverse. The Moogs immediately fan out, trying to cut off my escape, as if I won't run them over. I rev the engine and peel out, forcing one of the Moogs to dive out of the way. As I shoot by, I see the others already scrambling into the van.
"What are you doing?"
screams Maddie. "I think one of them had a gun," I shout back, weaving around a slow-moving sedan.
"Are you nuts? Stanley, slow down!"
I do the opposite. Flooring it, I blow through a red light. The convertible's tires screech as I jerk the wheel hard to the left, nearly fishtailing us through a turn. Maddie is thrown against her seatbelt, and I wince as she cries out in pain. In the rear view, I see the Moog van cut off by traffic. I realize that I've been holding my breath and let an exhale hiss through my teeth.
"Let me out," says Maddie. "Let me out of this car right now."
I start to slow down, trying to blend into the rest of the traffic. That's not going to be easy, considering my flashy car. I hope Sanders out there somewhere watching this all go down on his network of hacked cameras, that he's sending a drone to bail me out as we speak. The iMoog in my pocket vibrates with renewed vigor. Hold on, I say, punching the gas, just as the Moog's van comes barreling out of a side street, nearly clipping the convertible's bumper. The van is riding hard on our tail, trying to grind us off the road. Other cars let loose whining honks as we speed down the middle of the road. Maddie looks over her shoulder, staring in horror at the van bearing down on us and its stone-faced driver.
They're right behind us.
Her voice is almost a whisper. Her hand is clutching my arm, nails digging right through my shirt.
Why is this happening?
I don't respond. There's no lie I can think of that could possibly explain it. With sweaty fingers, I flick open a hidden panel on the steering wheel. Sander planned for this sort of thing. Sit back, I warn. Maddie looks at me, her frightened expression apparently not reserved just for the Moogs. I hit the button for nitrous oxide. The convertible's engine roars, and then bucks, and for a moment, I'm worried the car can't handle Sander's modification. Then, with a gut punch of pressure, it screams forward. We're going way over the speed limit. I'm too afraid to check the speedometer, keeping my eyes pinned to the road as I weave through traffic. Maddie is glued to her seat, terrified. Seeing us coming, other cars try to move out of the way. Red traffic lights fly by. I hear a siren, and briefly, blue lights flash across my rear view. But any cops are outdistanced before they can even make out my license plate. We're a blur. I keep driving until my iMoog stops vibrating, and then I swing the car into a secluded alley and kill the lights. My body hums with adrenaline. I can't believe what I just did, evading a pack of Moogs in a high-speed chase like something out of a movie. I'm an action hero. A mixture of euphoria and relief hits me. And I don't really know where the next part comes from. Maybe it's pure adrenaline, or maybe I'm just going totally crazy. But before I even realize I'm doing it, I lean into Maddie and start to kiss her. I guess it wasn't the right thing to do.
You bastard!
Maddie cries, pushing me away. She throws open her door, knocking over some nearby trash cans. In the dim light of the alley, I can see that her beautiful face is streaked with tears. Stunned from her reaction, I don't say anything as she runs out of the alley. Alone, in Sander's banged-up convertible, I'm left to ponder the adventure-filled life of a Lorik hero. Chapter 17. I abandon the convertible in the alley and head back to the John Hancock building on foot. I stick to side streets and back alleys as much as possible. My iMoog never vibrates. Wherever those Moogs came from, they're gone now. I call Sander to tell him what happened and catch him as he's on his way to try to find me. Just as I suspected, he was monitoring me the whole time and freaking out. It's past midnight when I make it back home. Sander is waiting for me outside the building. What the hell? He asks.
I don't know, I say. They just appeared.
A high-speed chase through the middle of Chicago? What were you thinking?
It was the only way.
Sander groans, dismissing that with a wave of his hand. You're acting like a child.
You said there weren't any Moogs in the city,
I protest.
So stupid, he says. I was so stupid to let you take that car, to even let you out of my sight all because of some girl.
She's fine, by the way, I snap.
Who cares? Sander hisses, getting right in my face. She doesn't matter. You matter. Do you understand what you've put at stake? The years of progress you've undone in one night, all for some stupid crush.
I take a step away from him. Don't talk about her that way.
He's being such a hypocrite. He was the one who wanted me to go after Maddie in the first place.
Sander rubs his hands over his face, exasperated.
Where did you leave the car?
I give him the rough address of the alley. It needs to be destroyed, he says. Our presence here, minimized. I'll handle that. You go upstairs and pack a bag.
What? Why?
We're leaving in the morning. I was close. So close to having a life that was more than just Sander,
more than just training. I pace around the penthouse, letting my gaze drift aimlessly across all the luxuries we've amassed over the last 5 years. 5 years living here in peace and comfort. All ruined because I was bored. When I killed that Moog in the elevator, I thought things would change. I thought that I would assume my destiny and begin the war against the Mogadorians. I thought that would make me happy. Instead, it's only made things worse. What felt best about killing that Moog wasn't that some small justice was done. It was that I had chosen how and when to do it. It was my choice. And yet now, my options are fewer than ever. Sander wants us back on the road, just when I was starting to figure things out. It doesn't seem right that he should get to call all the shots. Shouldn't I get some say in our next move? I can't bring myself to pack a bag. I'm still clinging to some hope that Sander will change his mind. I try to call Maddie, but her phone goes right to voicemail. Not that I would know what to say if she did answer. What kind of lie could I tell her? I spent the better part of an hour trying to compose an apology for nearly getting her killed, for scaring her, and for not even realizing that I was doing it. In the end, I settle on texting a simple, "I'm sorry." There's going to be no sleep for me tonight. I pass through Sander's workshop and into the lecture hall. There are automated training modules programmed into the room's interface. I select one at random and stride into the center of the room, holding my pipe staff. When the first ball bearing fires out of the lectern's turret, I don't deflect it with my telekinesis or bat it away with my pipe staff. I let it hit me, right in the chest. I suck in my breath as dull pain courses through my sternum. Gritting my teeth, I clasp my hands behind my back and lean forward. The next ball bearing strikes me a few inches to the left of the first, bruising my ribs. When the third ball bearing is fired, my instincts take over. I push it aside with my telekinesis and pivot to the side, anticipating the next shot. I spin my pipe staff over my head as the program really gears up, heavy bags swinging at me from behind, a mechanical tentacle grasping at me from the floor. My mind turns off. I fight. I'm not sure how long I keep going like that, dodging and swinging, acting instead of thinking. Eventually, I'm dripping with sweat, my shirt completely soaked through. It's then that the lecture hall's patterns change. The attacks become less predictable, more coordinated than the auto program could pull off. I realize that Sander has returned and climbed into the lectern's seat, his fingers dancing across the control panel. Our eyes meet as I leap over a metal-plated battering ram. His look is one of sadness and disappointment. "You didn't pack," he says. I square my shoulders and glare at him in defiance. "Go ahead," I want to tell him. "Throw everything you can at me. I can take it. I'm going to prove to Sander that I'm not his young ward anymore." "I suppose one last training session before we leave won't hurt," Sander says. A glimmering tennis ball-sized object floats up from the floor, emitting a disorienting strobe light. It makes the next round of projectiles harder to see, but I manage to catch them in the air, using my mind to hold them inches from my bruised chest. "That hasn't been decided yet," I say evenly as I launch one of the projectiles at the flashing ball, exploding it. It clatters to the floor, blinking out. "What hasn't been decided?" he asks. "That we're leaving." "No." A pair of heavy bags careens toward me, quickly followed by another volley of ball bearings. I swing the pipe staff as hard as I can at one of them, my muscles screaming in protest. The pipe staff shreds through the bag, sending sand spilling onto the floor. One of the ball bearings strikes me in the hip, but I catch the others and hurl them back the way they came. The turrets in the wall hiss and pop when the ball bearings re-enter their barrels the wrong way. There's a short puff of smoke, and then they hang dormant. "I get a vote," I tell him, "and I vote we stay." "That's impossible," Sander replies. "You don't understand what's at stake. You're not thinking clearly." Three drones deploy from the floor. I've never fought that many at once before.
One is the propeller-powered toaster that just days ago we were trying out on the roof. The others I haven't seen before. They're the size of soccer balls, metal-plated, with scopes attached to the front. The toaster bobs in front of me, distracting me as the other two flank me. When they're in position, the soccer balls emit two bursts of electricity, jolting me. I retreat toward the back of the room, the drones zapping at me. My ears are ringing from the last shock. The drones close in, pursuing me. I'm running out of room. Before I realize what I'm doing, I run up the wall. My aim was to flip off the wall, to land behind the drones. But something is different. I don't feel gravity pulling at me. I plant my feet. I'm standing on the wall. Except for a sudden feeling of vertigo, it feels no different than standing on the ground. My legacy. I've developed one of my legacies. Staring at me, Sander is too stunned to adjust the course of the drones. The toaster crashes into the wall. From above, I swing my pipe staff down on the two floating soccer balls, destroying them both. Sander lets out a cry of triumph. "Do you see?" he shouts. "Do you see what you're capable of? My young ward gets an upgrade." "Upgrade?" I growl. I run up the rest of the wall and onto the ceiling. The room turns upside down. I sprint across the ceiling that's now the floor to me, gathering up a head of steam. When I'm right above Sander and the lectern, I jump, twist in midair, and bring my pipe staff shearing down on the lectern. The control panel explodes in a waterfall of sparks. Sander dives aside, grunting as he lands hard on his shoulder. My pipe staff is carved deep into the front of the lectern, practically cutting it in two. It lets out a series of ear-splitting mechanical squawks, and then the lectern hall goes dark. "I'm not one of your gadgets," I shout into the darkness. "You don't get to just control me." Starbursts of light flash across my vision as my eyes try to adjust to the darkness. I can't quite see Sander, but I can hear him shakily climb to his feet. I don't think that," Sander says. I'm thankful I can't see his face, the hurt plain enough in his voice. "Everything I've ever done, all these years," he stops, searching for words. As I come back down to Earth, the memories of the night come back to me. I realize what I've done. "9, I feel Sander's hand on my shoulder. I don't want to hear this. I shrug his hand roughly away and run. Chapter 18. The sun is beginning to rise. The air is still cool, chilling my skin under my sweat-dampened t-shirt. I fled the John Hancock building with nothing but the clothes on my back, the same clothes I wore on my ruined date the night before, and my cell phone and iMoog tucked into my back pockets. A part of me knows that I'll need to go back to Sander eventually. But right now, I'm ignoring that part as hard as I can. I want to know how long I can last out here on my own. The day is just beginning. I can do anything I choose with it. I feel like Spider-Man, using my newest legacy to stand on the outside of an anonymous Chicago skyscraper, 50 stories up. Beneath my feet, inside the windows, the office building's automatic lights are coming on. I gaze down at the streets below, the city just starting to wake up. Thanks to my anti-gravity legacy, I'm seeing Chicago from angles I never imagined. I sprint across the skyscraper's windows, then jump across the narrow gap between buildings. On the next building, I jog upward, bounding over a stone gargoyle until I'm balancing right on the roof ledge. I walk across the ledge, my arms spread out like a tightrope walker, even though there's no chance of me losing my balance. Hundreds of feet above the ground, and it's as if I'm on the sidewalk. This would have come in handy that first day at the Windy City Wall. Across the street, I catch sight of an executive type settling in behind his desk with his morning coffee. That's my signal to rein it in. I don't need Sander around to tell me it'd be a bad idea to be seen strolling around on the sides of buildings. I hop onto the roof. For a while, I just sit and watch the sun coming up. I've got no place to be. It's peaceful. When the sun hangs in full view above me, the noise of the city below increasing to rush hour decibels, I decide to check my cell phone. 3 voicemails and 4 text messages, all of them from Sander. I delete them. Suddenly, I'm very tired. I didn't sleep at all last night. It's a nice day, and there's a sense of calm on this rooftop. My eyelids start to feel heavy. I curl up in a shady spot near the edge of the precipice. The roof is hard, but my body is too exhausted to do much complaining. For some reason, my mind drifts to the dream I had of Lorien. I think about the way I flung myself at Sander, getting us both all muddy, and the way he lifted me into the air afterward, grinning. That was a nice memory. I hope I dream it again. I don't dream at all. It's a deep sleep, and when I finally wake up, the sun has almost set. I've slept away the entire day. My body aches, both from the exertion of the night before and from passing out on a slab of hard rooftop. Groaning and stretching, I sit up. I decide to check my cell phone again, even though I know what's waiting for me. More voicemails and texts from Sander, the texts increasingly panicked as he begs me to let him know where I am, that I'm all right. My stomach turns over with guilt. I'll let him know eventually, I decide. I just need more time. And then I see it. A single text from the only other number programmed into my phone. Maddie. Maybe we can try again if you promise no cars. I leap to my feet, punching the air in celebration. After everything I put her through last night, even after the whole thing with the kiss, and she still wants to see me again. That has to mean something, right? With one simple text, Maddie has reassured me that the connection I felt between us is real. Even knowing that it can never be simple and easy between us, that eventually this brief freedom I have will be gone, and I'll be swept back up in my destiny. Even knowing all that, I still have to see her. I know I can set things right between us, and maybe I can have just one perfect, normal moment. I bound across the rooftops as the sun sets, a shadow above the heads of tired commuters. I chart a course across walls and windows and power lines, heading for Maddie's house. I'm cautious during my approach. The Moogs were following me last night, so they're obviously on to me. I need to make sure they're not still lurking around. They could be anywhere. I prowl the surrounding blocks, sticking to the rooftops, one eye always on my iMoog. There's no sign of any danger. From across the street, I scope out Maddie's house. I feel sort of like a stalker. The sight of parents would almost be as bad as the sight of Moogs. Showing up unannounced might not go over too well with Maddie's folks. I don't want to have to throw pebbles at her window. I climb up the building opposite Maddie's, careful to stay hidden, and watch her windows. She told me that her parents travel a lot. It looks like I've lucked out, and that's the case tonight. The only movement I see in the apartment is Maddie, lounging on a couch with her laptop. It feels gross to spy on her longer than necessary, so I walk back down to the street and approach her building the normal way. A few seconds after I buzz her, Maddie's voice pipes uncertainly out of the intercom. "Hello?" "Hi," I say into the mic. "It's Stanley." There's a lengthy pause, long enough for me to consider that this was a stupid idea. She could be peering down at me right now, hoping that I'll slink off into the night and leave her alone. Or, worse yet, she could be calling the cops. I'm relieved when the door finally buzzes, letting me in. Maddie's apartment is on the 3rd floor. I bound up the stairs. She's waiting for me in the hallway, dressed in baggy pajama pants, a tank top, and an unbuttoned cardigan sweater. "Are you okay?" Maddie asks as soon as she sees me. I realize how I must look. I'm wearing the same clothes I wore yesterday, and in the time since then, I've endured my most intense lecture hall workout ever and slept on a rooftop. Belatedly, I run a hand through my hair and try to brush some wrinkles out of my t-shirt. I've had a really bad 24 hours, I tell her, honestly. I think I know what you mean. She gives me a nervous little smile. So? I'm sorry to just show up, I explain, in a rush to diffuse the awkwardness. I'm not sure when I'll be able to see you again, and I wanted to apologize in person. Thank you for coming, Maddie says, a note of relief in her voice. And then she's hugging me, her face pressed into my chest. I let myself enjoy that moment, trying to commit to memory how her body feels pressed against me, wrapped in my arms. Don't take this the wrong way, she whispers. But you kind of smell. Just as I thought, Maddie's parents are out of town. She invites me in, joking that breaking their rule about having boys over while they're away is nothing after flagrantly violating their stance against high-speed car chases. I laugh, but I also notice the bruise peeking out from under Maddie's sweater where the seatbelt dug into her shoulder, and I feel guilty all over again. Maddie insists that I take a shower. She gives me a pair of her dad's sweatpants and a faded NASA t-shirt and sends me into the bathroom to get cleaned up. I linger in the shower. The water is hot and feels good on my sore muscles. For a while, I let myself imagine that I'm just another teenager grabbing a shower after sneaking over to his girlfriend's house while her parents are out of town. Not that Maddie is my girlfriend, but she could be. It's strange to be in a house like this. Obviously, it doesn't match the John Hancock penthouse in opulence, but it makes up for that in coziness. Unlike where Sander and I have been staying, Maddie's apartment actually feels lived in. The furniture is broken in. There are pictures of Maddie and her parents everywhere. Knickknacks and trinkets clutter bookshelves, mementos from trips taken as a family. There's an entire history here. I'm envious. Maddie is waiting for me in her bedroom when I get out of the shower. I realize it's the first time I've ever been in a normal kid's bedroom. There are pictures of Maddie and her friends, school trophies, posters of movie stars on the walls. It's so different from my utilitarian room, filled with just video game systems and dirty laundry. She pats the bed and I sit down next to her. I can tell she's been trying to work out what I'm doing here, why I arrived in such a state. Tell me the truth, she begins. Did you run away from home? Kind of, I reply, a little embarrassed. I lie back on the bed, draping an arm over my face. Maddie lies down next to me, trying to look at me. Do you want to talk about it? I do, but how much can I tell her? I got in a fight with my uncle. Because of the car? Yeah. Well, not really. That was like the straw that broke the camel's back. It's been building up for a while. Maddie makes an encouraging noise, and I realize that she's holding my hand. Then, it all comes pouring out of me. I feel like my uncle has my entire life mapped out. Like every decision that affects me, I just have no control over. And then, when I do try to act on my own, something horrible happens, like last night. I think about the bruises on Maddie's shoulder. As if sensing my guilt, she gives my hand an encouraging squeeze. I want to get away from everything, from my entire life, but I feel like any decision I make, I'll just end up regretting. I lift my arm from my face and squint at her in the darkness. Does that make any sense at all? I think I see tears in Maddie's eyes. She nods her head. Yes, she says quietly. We lie on her bed, holding hands. Eventually, just like it did in the lecture hall, my mind shuts off. I don't want anything more than this. I have to figure things out with Sander tomorrow. But for tonight, this is perfect. Normal. We fall asleep. Chapter 19. At some point, I feel Maddie get out of bed and leave the room. I linger in that space between being asleep and awake, vaguely aware that it is morning. Maddie's bed is insanely comfortable, and I don't want to get up. In my dreamy state, I let myself wonder how many days Maddie's parents will be out of town.
Maybe I can stretch this vacation from responsibility out a little further. There is a shuffling next to the bed. Probably Maddie returning. Fingers touch my arm. They're strangely cold. My eyes snap open. Two thin, pale men stand over me, both of them with their jet-black hair shorn close to their skulls. The Mogadorians have found me. Almost more frightening than the pair of ugly faces glaring down at me is the empty spot in the bed next to me. Maddie, what have they done to her? A surge of fear breaks over me. These Mogs might be able to capture me, but they can't actually hurt me. Not when I'm protected by the Loric charm. Maddie, on the other hand, they could do whatever they want to her. For a moment, I hope this is some really intense nightmare. When they make a grab for my arms and legs, working in tandem to pin me down, I know it's real. I squirm away from the one grabbing my ankles and kick him in the chest with as much strength as my still groggy body can muster. The Moog goes crashing backward into Maddie's desk, knocking through her things. Her purse goes tumbling to the floor, spilling its contents next to a newly broken swimming trophy. When the Moog tries to regain his feet, he ends up shoving Maddie's laptop to the floor as well. I've made a mess of her room. I've made a mess of her life. The other one's gotten hold of my wrists and is pinning me to the bed. He grunts as I thrash against his grip, his face close enough that I can smell his sour breath. His face is close enough, in fact, that I can headbutt him. The blow caves in the Moog's nose. His grip on my wrists loosens, and I'm able to wriggle free. I bring my legs up, doing a backward somersault. My feet hit the wall, and just like that, my perspective shifts, the anti-gravity legacy kicking in. I'm eye level with one of them, even though our bodies are perpendicular, and I punch him in the face. Both Moogs are taken aback that I'm suddenly running across the ceiling. Good. That should buy me a second or two. I need to find Maddie and get us out of here. I wonder if she keeps an emergency bag hidden somewhere, but then I realize that keeping a bag of road supplies handy isn't at all a human thing to do. I think about grabbing her purse, but when I see the contents spilled out of it onto the floor, dozens of plastic IDs with her photo smiling up at me, why does she have so many IDs anyway, I wonder? I know there's no time. Sander will just have to make her a new identity on the fly. I kick open her bedroom door from the ceiling, leaping over the uppermost part of the doorframe as I go. There's another Moog waiting outside, but he didn't expect me to come from above. The ones behind me shout a warning to their friend. Too late. With a roar, I grab the surprised Moog under the chin with both my hands. Then I jump from the ceiling, simultaneously pulling back on his head. The physics are impossible. I can hear bones popping inside the scout as I spike his head into the ground, his forehead touching the floor a few inches from his heels. The Moog disintegrates into a cloud of ash. The pictures of Maddie's family that line the hallway are covered in dust. I feel guilty once again. Maddie's home felt so perfect when I arrived last night, and now, by bringing the fight here, I've roped her and her perfect family into an intergalactic war. Great. I run back up the wall, onto the ceiling, and sprint toward Maddie's living room, screaming her name. The two Moogs from the bedroom chase after me, one clutching his broken face. There are three more of them in the living room. Two of them flank the couch where Maddie sits, with her head in her hands. I can't tell if she's hurt, or crying, or both. "Maddie!" I shout. "We have to run!" She flinches at the sound of my voice, but otherwise remains still. The third Mogadorian stands in front of the apartment's door. He smiles when he sees me. It's a sickening expression. His teeth are gray and rotting, pointing in all the wrong directions. This one is larger than the others. He must be the leader. A wicked-looking sword dangles from his hip, but he makes no move to reach for it. He seems content to just block our only exit. He doesn't realize that there's always another exit when you can walk on walls. I stoop down, and with a shout, tear the ceiling fan at my feet from its moorings. I wish I had my pipe staff, but this will have to do. With the exception of their leader, the Mogadorians have all converged on me. I jump off the ceiling with the fan in hand, bringing it down on top of the closest Moog's head. The wooden fan blade snaps in half as it splits his skull.
His body immediately decomposes into ash, mixing with fan fragments on Maddie's carpet. Two down, four to go. I spin in a circle, swinging the remains of the fan around as I do. My assailants are all forced back a step as I gather momentum. I let the fan loose, and it goes flying between two Moogs. They smirk, thinking I've missed them, but they were never my intended target. Behind them, the living room window shatters, glass and pieces of wood spraying into the street below. There's our exit. One of the Moogs manages to wrap his arms around me from behind. Another, the one whose nose I broke, forgets the rules and hauls off to punch me. A warm sensation spreads across my face as a fresh bruise spreads across his, and he staggers. I elbow the other Moog in the gut, breaking free. "Maddie!" I shout, bull-rushing her. One of the Mogadorians tries to cut me off. I drop my shoulder low, like I would to duck under a heavy bag in the lecture hall, and drive into his knees. The Moog flips over me and goes smashing through a coffee table. At the door, I hear the leader quietly chuckle. I'm not sure what's funny about his squad getting their asses handed to them. At least he's a good sport. I grab Maddie by the shoulders and pull her to her feet. Her hands fall to her sides, and I can see that her face is ashen. Her eyes are red-rimmed and distant, totally checked out. I don't even want to imagine what the Moogs did to shut her down like this. She's dead weight in my arms. "Come on!" I shout, shaking her by the shoulders. And then, something strange happens. I feel energy welling up in my core and rushing out through my limbs, fingertips tingling. Maddie must feel something too. A rush, a burst of energy, because her eyes snap into focus. What are you doing? She says in a shaky voice. I don't know how I know, or even exactly how I did it, but I'm certain that a new legacy has just presented itself based on the feeling coursing through me. Just trust me for now, I say. Go with it, okay? Taking Maddie by the hand, I run toward the nearest wall. The Moog with the broken nose tries to cut us off, but I knock an end table into his legs, upending him. When we reach the wall, I feel that rush again and know instinctively that I've extended my anti-gravity legacy to Maddie. That must be what I felt just a second ago. I now have the ability to share my powers with someone else, but I have no idea how long it will last. I kick out, still holding her hand, and feel the axis of the room shift as I run up the wall. At first, it feels like Maddie's just going to let me drag her, but then she follows, defying gravity a few steps behind me. I smile to myself as she lets out a gasp, not quite believing what she's doing. "Almost there," I shout over my shoulder. I lead us toward the window. Escape is only a few feet away. I realize that we aren't being chased anymore. Are they letting us go? Suddenly, Maddie plants her feet. I jerk to a stop, still holding her hand. I turn to face her, expecting one of the Moogs to have grabbed her. But she's just standing there. Maddie? The sight of her, eyes downcast, face ghostly pale, doesn't make any sense to me. Something tells me I should run, but I can't bring myself to let go of her hand. I look down and see a taser in a white-knuckled grip in her free hand. Where did she get that? "I'm sorry," she says. And then she tases me. The electric current surges through us both. We fall off the ceiling, both of us spasming, bouncing hard off the floor. The Moogs descend on us. Chapter 20. I come to in the back of a van. I'm seated on a bench, my hands bound behind me, my ankles similarly secured. I can tell that we're traveling fast. My spine bounces uncomfortably against the van's steel wall. Maddie is seated across from me. The look of shell shock has returned to her face. She keeps her eyes pinned to the van's floor. They haven't even bothered to tie her up. It's starting to dawn on me why that is, but I put it out of my head. I'm not ready to think about it now. Next to Maddie is the huge Mogadorian from the apartment. He studies a small object, turning it over in his thick hands. It's my eye Moog. The Moog notices that I'm awake and watching him. His lips peel back, and I'm forced to endure his sickening smile up close.
Cute toy, he says, holding up my iMoog.
The screen is littered with red dots.
Too bad it didn't do you any good this time.
He crushes the device between his hands, dropping it mangled to the van floor. He watches with amusement as I strain against my bonds. There's no give at all in the metal shackles securing my wrists and ankles. I take a closer look around the back of the van. The benches on either side are bolted to the floor, a chain-link mesh separating us from the driver, nothing else of note. There's no escape. I consider throwing myself at him. Maybe I can get close enough to bite him. However, I'm not just shackled. I'm also chained to the bench. They've taken every precaution.
You're stuck with me, says the Moog, sensing my resignation.
I grit my teeth and stare at him. He smiles back.
Tell me, where is your sepan?
Rio de Janeiro, I reply, picking the first place that comes to mind. He scoffs.
How stupid do you think we are?
Pretty freaking stupid.
We found you, didn't we? One of my scouts goes missing. His last reported location is the Chicago lakefront, tailing a boy matching your description. For my scout to simply disappear, I figure you brought him someplace. So you must have a safe house in the area.
He kicks the broken pieces of my iMoog.
You must have a way to get the drop on him.
I try to keep my expression neutral, but inside, I'm screaming. This is my fault.
Where is your sepan? Repeats the Moog. Where is your safe house?
You don't know? I ask. Tough luck, dude. I guess you're on your own. He sighs.
So much bravado. I wonder if that will hold true once we've killed our way to whatever number you are.
My mind races. I try to figure out how much the Moogs could know. They had my description, knew that I liked the lakefront, and guessed that we had some way to see them coming. What else could they know? How much did I tell Maddie about my life?
Maddie.
I look over at her. It had to be her. She was helping them. But why would she do that? And how long has it been going on? Did they get to her after the car chase? Coerce her somehow? Could she be one of them? I dismiss the last possibility. My iMoog would have alerted me. I remember the mess my fight with the Mogadorians made in Maddie's room, the contents of her purse all over the floor. So many ID cards, way more than normal. I didn't think much of it in the heat of battle. Those IDs, just like the one I have for Windy City Wall, but different. I realized they were membership IDs for rec centers all over Chicago. My stomach turns over as I think back to the way Maddie looked at me on that first day. So interested at first, yet nervous when I noticed her, and then disappearing before I could talk to her.
You were looking for me, I say, dumbfounded.
The Mogadorian lounges back, lazily draping an arm around Maddie's shoulders. She shudders and attempts to shrink away, but he holds her close. Her just happening to show up at the thrift store, taking my picture. The way the Moogs appeared in that van on the night of our date. How mad she was at the end of the car chase. None of it was coincidence. As much as I don't want it to, suddenly, Maddie's interest in me begins to make sense.
You, Lorien, act so high and mighty, yet you're just like the humans. All it takes is a pretty face to cloud your judgment.
He pinches Maddie's cheek. I make a futile lunge forward, only succeeding in rattling my chains and hurting my wrists. The Moog chortles.
So chivalrous, he sneers. Are you so dense that you don't realize what's happened? She betrayed you, boy. The girl works for us. We've had her for some time, although we didn't know what to do with her. Humans, so useless, you know. But when we asked her to find you, she did a bang-up job. didn't you, sweetheart?
He gives Maddie a mockingly affectionate squeeze. I know all this is true as the electric shock she pumped into my body, but I don't want to believe it. There has to be an explanation. I ignore the Moog, trying to catch Maddie's eye. Why? I ask her. Her mouth tightens, almost as if she has to stop herself from answering. He responds for her.
Her father, the so-called astronomer, saw something he shouldn't have, he says. These primitives and their telescopes, sometimes they get lucky. We were forced to detain him and her mother.
I can see the pain in Maddie's face as the Moog gleefully finishes his explanation.
She traded you for them.